Welcome to Global Minnesota Podcasts, connecting, informing, and engaging Minnesotans with the world and exploring important international issues. For a complete list of programs and to join us, visit globalminnesota.org.
There's obviously a lot happening with the new administration in Washington, and I'm going to get back to that. Tomorrow we have the Secretary of State and Secretary of Homeland Security going to Mexico and meeting with the President and senior officials. That's going to be important, I think, that visit. What they talk about, what they come away with, and what happens moving forward. And I'm going to talk about that in a second. But let me just take a step back and talk and give you my view about what's happening in this Latin America of ours, in this hemisphere, and with our closest neighbors. I should start with a caveat, which is that you really can't talk in a meaningful way about Latin America or even U.S. policy. This is a region that is very diverse. Differences among countries are becoming, I think, greater, not being reduced. So you have to be, I think, careful at making generalizations about a region that is so differentiated. But I want to highlight a few countries and a few trends and points that I think are important to note. Let me start with the election that took place Sunday in Ecuador. Rafael Correa, who's been the president of Ecuador over the last decade, has a PhD from University of Illinois in economics, is a representative of what many, many analysts and journalists have called the pink tide in Latin America. The pink tide was a trend of leaders who came to power as a result of discredited political institutions, political parties. The old order was seen as not delivering and not serving the people. Many of them were charismatic, promised a lot to address the social agenda, which they argued had been neglected by governments that were more conservative, more focused on the market, and that left the poor excluded from basic parts of social, political, economic life. These governments were also fueled by an economic boom. Ecuador is a major oil producer. Oil prices went up. Rafael Correa was elected in 2006. He assumed office in 2007. And remember, oil prices were high, and that gave him a lot of resources to build roads, build infrastructure, to pursue education changes. And this is what he did in Ecuador. The cost was that he really was one-man rule. He made all the decisions, controlled the institutions, was very, attacked the press in Ecuador, but still there's little denying that people benefited and that he recognized people that had been ignored in previous governments. He's been in office for a decade. In the previous decade to Rafael Correa, there were five different presidents. So there was enormous instability, and Correa has been in power and continuity for a decade. He did not run for re-election. There is indefinite re-election in Ecuador, but it applies to the next government, not to him. But he does have his former vice president, whose first name is Lenin Moreno, who came in first, and now there's gonna be a second round on April 2nd. And I think it's gonna be quite a tight race. This is a polarized country. But I think no matter who wins on April 2nd, there's the end of an era and the end of a cycle in Ecuador of the party of good economic times fueled by high oil prices and lots of public spending. The situation in Ecuador is serious. There's a recession. The economy is predicted to contract by over 2.5%. Oil prices, the decline in oil prices is a very important factor in that, but there's also other factors, mismanagement of the economy and other questions. And there have to be adjustments in Ecuador moving forward. There's gonna be less money to spend, and all of the people that benefited over the previous decade from this boom have high expectations, demands, and are putting pressures on a government that will have a hard time responding. No matter if the Correa's candidate wins or the opposition candidate wins. The opposition candidate is Guillermo Lasso, who's a business leader, more conservative from the coastal town of Guayaquil. Of course, the embodiment of this pink tide was Hugo Chavez himself. Came to power in 1999 and talked about 21st century socialism. Took advantage of the corrupt, discredited political institutions in Venezuela. And I think he put his finger on a legitimate grievance that many Venezuelans felt, that they were being neglected by governments that didn't care about their needs and that weren't devising social policies in order to improve their well-being. He also rode this wave more than Ecuador. Venezuela is a completely oil-dependent economy. That's the only thing they produced. When he came to office, oil was under $10. It went up to over $140. That gives you a lot of money to do a lot of things. And he spent. And he won election after election. But he also consolidated power, concentrated power, and he made every decision in the country. Every important decision was made by one man, and that was Hugo Chavez. So there were no institutions, there was no effort to try to build any kind of political decision-making. Everything depended on him. He did reduce poverty, and he did make people feel part of the national project. He was a charismatic leader, a very impressive orator. But ultimately, even though he identified the problem, he couldn't provide the solution. Because in this day and age, one person making all decisions simply doesn't work. And so this was a government that proved to be completely incompetent, wildly corrupt. And he died from cancer in March of 2013. And his successor, Nicolas Maduro, who's the current president, didn't have Chavez's charisma, didn't have his political skills, and of course didn't have his money, because the money really started to be a problem because oil prices, that's the time, precisely the time that he passed away is when oil prices started to go down. So he left his successor in an extremely difficult situation. And today Venezuela, I think, has the most profound crisis in the hemisphere. Inflation over 1,000%, shortages of basic goods, long lines. You've seen the pictures, you've read the articles, it's been amply reported. And also a security problem, the economic crisis and also security problem. There's Caracas, the capital of Venezuela, is today the murder capital of the world. Maduro is still in power. There are elections the end of next year, but the Congress, the Assembly, is controlled by the opposition that won overwhelmingly in elections in December of 2015. Maduro has a very low level of support. It's a tragic situation and a humanitarian quite a crisis of great dimensions. We can go to other cases. Evo Morales is the president of Bolivia. He came in a year before Correa did in Ecuador. He's the first indigenous president in a country that has a majority indigenous population. Again, somebody who pursued social policies and tried to bring in groups, indigenous groups and others, poor, that had been left out of the political system, excluded, and he brought them in. He also had the commodity, natural gas. which also fueled his economic boom. In contrast to Chavez and Correa, the Bolivian economy, he was, Morales was very smart. He gave a very well-known economist the responsibility to run the economy, and he ran it very well. Very much fiscal discipline, responsible. The World Bank and the IMF praised Bolivia's management of the economy. But nonetheless, there was this as well, a concentration of power, a new constitution, as there was in Ecuador and Venezuela, and again, also part of the pink tide. There are other cases I can refer to, and he's been in power in a country which was known for political stability. He's been in power since 2006. So we have this tremendous continuity, but not these leaders are not, don't have the popularity that they had before. There's a desire for change, but in the case of Bolivia, there's really no opposition or challenge to Morales's power. There are other cases in South America that are not part of the 21st century socialism, but are also, I think, fit within this larger pattern, this larger trend. There were 12 years of Peronist government in Argentina. The Kirchners, Néstor Kirchner, and then his wife, Cristina Fernández Kirchner, were in power for 12 years, also riding the commodity wave, also very much of a populist government, protectionist economic policies. And then there was the election at the end of last year, of 2015, excuse me, in November, when a more conservative candidate won, Mauricio Macri. Brazil, 13 years of the Workers' Party rule, starting with Lula Ignacio da Silva, worker or union leader in Brazil, probably the most, for many years, the most charismatic, the most beloved leader in Latin America. When President Obama came in 2009, he was with Lula at a meeting in London, and he says, "You're the most popular leader in the world." That's what President Obama said about President Lula. In 2010, Brazil grew by 7.5%. 40 million people were lifted out of poverty in Brazil. Again, Brazil is also an exporter of commodities. They rode the wave, and Lula, on top of everything else, had this enormous charisma, and things were going great. And if you read The Economist, the Brazil was on the cover of The Economist, the star is rising, and Brazil is the greatest. So you have all these countries that are kind of moving this, and a big part of this pink tide story is the rise of China and the involvement and engagement of China in Latin America. Who were buying these commodities? It was China. And starting in around 2005, China becomes heavily involved in Latin America, is buying up copper, is buying up iron ore, buying up all of the commodities to meet their own development goals and agenda. And Latin America is rich in commodities, and so prices are going up, and China is very much a part of this. China becomes the leading trade partner of Brazil, Chile, Peru, and the second trading partner of a lot of other countries. So China is an important part of this. China is financing countries. We have in my organization, we have a database of Chinese finance in Latin America. We track that closely. Since 2005, more than $120 billion in financing in Latin America. Half of that to Venezuela, but also Ecuador, also Argentina, Brazil, other countries. China is an important part of this this change. But what happens? Why does this end? Well, first of all, commodity prices begin to decline, and so they just don't have the money. It's not as more complicated than that. A lot of what was happening, what seemed like an ideological trend, was really underwritten by rising commodity prices. And the second is that there's just a question of being exhausted and wanting people wanting change. We saw that in this country in 2008. We saw it in the recent election in 2016. 13 years, 10 years, 11 years, 12 years in these all these countries, you know, let's try something else, especially if these governments are not delivering, and they couldn't deliver because they simply didn't have the resources, and there have been a lot of pressures for more delivery. This trend, by the way, is not, or this phenomena in Latin America is not just of the left or the right. I think it's not necessarily ideological. I lived in Peru in the late 1980s, early 1990, when Alberto Fujimori was elected president of Peru in the second round against Mario Vargas Llosa in a very interesting election, and I was living there at the time. Again, this is not the pink tide because he wasn't a man of the left, Fujimori. But like the others, he was somebody who took advantage of the discrediting, the collapse of political parties in Peru and the people's contempt for politicians. And he knew how to tap into that. If that sounds familiar. That was Fujimori. That's what he did in Peru. He tapped into that discontent. And he was in power for a decade in Peru. Concentrated power, controlled the military, had a strong alliance with the private sector, with the business community, and really was very skillful in discrediting the opposition and dividing the opposition, and managed to stay in power for a decade. Today we're at a different point. We're at a point where the politics is becoming a little bit more pragmatic. There's a more centrist government in Brazil after the impeachment of the former president of the Workers' Party, Dilma Rousseff. And as I mentioned before, we have, which I think is the most significant, the election of a new president in Argentina, Mauricio Macri, a business leader who has a more business-friendly, investment-friendly policies. It is moving a very different direction than we've seen over the last decade in Argentina. Subsidies are being lifted, and some of the distortions are being addressed, but these adjustments are very painful. And poverty rates have gone up in Argentina, and there are elections coming up, legislative elections, in October of this year. And what do you do if you're the government of Argentina? Do you pull back, and that way your party is going to lose, and that puts at risk your whole government? If your party loses, if you do badly in the elections, that weakens the government. And in Argentina, we've seen in the past, that's a real problem for just keeping these governments in place. Or do you start spending, social spending? Well, if you do that, you can maybe ensure that you win in the elections, but you're basically doing what you criticize. You're doing the same thing that you criticized, which is spending more than you have and so forth. So there's a dilemma there for a lot of these governments. This fiscal space simply doesn't exist as it existed before. So my view, we're moving to a new kind of politics, a more centrist, pragmatic politics in a number of important countries. But it's a very difficult moment because simply the governments don't have the resources, and I don't see that there's going to be, well, now we have a decade of centrist governments or more conservative governments. I think it's going to be much more short-lived. They're not going to be 12 years or 13 years of Workers' Party or, in the case of Chavez, since 1999. So this, I think, is what we're seeing in Latin America. We're also seeing this in the context, and I think this is an important point, of corruption scandals. The construction company Odebrecht of Brazil has been involved in the corruption scandals and have involved a number of Latin American countries where there are investigations going on and very, very serious in terms of bribery for major projects, Peru and Ecuador and elsewhere, Argentina, accusations in Colombia, although they haven't been investigated or verified, but there are investigations going on. There's a lot there over a long period of time. In Peru, there are three former presidents of the country that may go to jail for accepting bribes from Odebrecht. We'll see what happens. The good story of the corruption scandals is that there are investigations taking place that the justice system is working more, in a more independent way, and more vigorous, and pursuing this, which is great. Corruption is not new in Latin America or anywhere else. It's been around forever. But the fact that the justice systems are pursuing this, and the media and the press are also playing a central role in Brazil. At the same time, this further undermines confidence in institutions and encourages cynicism and makes people, investors, business people, want to let's see how this plays out. Let's see what actually the situation here, because this is still an ongoing drama that's unfolding in many of these countries. But the irony of all of this, of what I described about this move towards more pragmatism, centrism, and the like, is that many countries are moving towards this, open markets and freer trade. And in Washington, where administrations of both parties, since I've been there certainly in the last 25 years, have urged Latin American governments, have encouraged them to pursue this path, the United States seems to be heading in a different direction, in dramatically the opposite direction. So Latin America is going in one direction, the United States, which is the direction the U.S. always told Latin America to go in, and they're doing it, and now the United States seems to be going in another direction. Very briefly, other encouraging developments in the region. The peace agreement in Colombia is certainly one. I lived there 40 years ago, went to school in Colombia, studied political science, international relations. I know about the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia. They've been a serious problem. There's been a lot of cost. And now there's the opportunity to build a sustainable peace. I think it's very important. It's not going to be easy. And I think I want to applaud the Colombian colleagues who are here and their efforts to try to build collaborative relationships, because I think we have to all be involved in this together. This is not a Colombian problem. This is a problem for the hemisphere. So I think that's extremely positive. But I also think it's going to be difficult for the Colombian government, the state, really to, for example, on the drug issue, a lot of cultivation has gone up in the last couple of years. Those coca growers, the drug economy has to change to a legal economy. That's going to require enormous effort, resources, and the like, coordination, and that's a test. And that's the bet that President Santos is making. Hopefully, it will happen. Well, just as the FARC, which emerged during the Cold War in 1964, is now handing in their arms and demobilizing. U.S.-Cuba relations took a dramatic turn in December of 2014. I happened to be in Havana at the time for a conference sponsored by the Diplomatic Academy of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs on U.S.-Cuba relations. I can tell you that nobody at that conference had a clue. No Cuban, or at least any of the Cubans that I spoke to, or some of the U.S. scholars who were there, who know Cuba and follow Cuba a lot more closely than I have, had any idea that this was going to be announced at noon on TV by Raul Castro and Barack Obama, that the decision had been made to normalize relations between the two countries. That was a dramatic policy shift, I think long overdue. And I think that's also, as President Obama said, this was a relic of the Cold War, this policy. And Obama has begun to take the steps that he did. He did the steps that he could as the president to try to put in place the greater opening of commerce, trade, investment, and travel to Cuba. In Cuba itself, I think the trend line is on general positive, but the economic reforms that were undertaken by Raul Castro, the current president, Fidel Castro's brother, have been too slow, and the political opening has been limited. A year from now, Raul Castro is scheduled to step down as president. It'll be the first time since 1959 that Cuba won't be led by either Fidel or Raul Castro. So that's something else to watch in Cuba. Cuba had been sustained for a long time, in part by subsidies from the Venezuelan government. There was a very close relationship between Hugo Chavez and Fidel Castro, especially, and Venezuela had a lot of oil. Cuba needed the oil and resold the oil in the international market. That was very, very important of its economy. And the other part of its economy is remittances from the United States. There are a lot of Cuban Americans that send remittances back to their families, and remittances in general is very, very important for the Latin American economies, not only in Cuba, but in Central America, in El Salvador, Honduras, Mexico, even Colombia, it's important source as well. My organization, Inter-American Dialogue, estimates there are about $70 billion worth of remittances that go into Latin America each year. The situation is different in Mexico and Central America than the one I described before. Both Mexico and Central America are so profoundly connected to the United States. There was no pink tide. The role of China was there, but the role of China was very different. With Mexico, it was more as a competitor in manufacturers rather than buying commodities, oil, or others in Mexico. So the role is very, very different. The Central American countries are, I think, after Venezuela, which has the highest homicide rate in the world, has among the highest homicide rates, Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras. A lot of it's fueled by the drug trade, gangs, very weak institutions, governance, and no rule of law, or very little weak rule of law, and is now today the largest source of migration to the United States from the region. As you know, Mexico, which despite what one hears, there's a net zero migration. There are as many people coming from the United States to Mexico as there are from Mexico to the United States. That's not true in the case of Central America. Mexico itself, there's a mixed picture. Some sectors, I think, are quite vibrant, economic sectors. As I said, the migration to the United States has declined, in part because of economic opportunities in Mexico itself. But still, Mexico has high levels of poverty, inequality, corruption, and continued violence and insecurity. But it's very, very hitched to the United States, which is important to note when one talks about what options does Mexico have today in this political context. 80% of all Mexican exports go to the United States. And even if there are other options to pursue, in the short term, that's very, very difficult, because of the profound links and connections between the two governments. On September 5th, 2011, George W. Bush said in Washington, and I agree with him, that Mexico is probably the most important bilateral relationship the United States has in the world. There's no other country with which the United States has as many relationships at the working level in terms of agencies, departments, on trade, environment, border issues, migration, drugs, every issue that you can imagine, every agency of the US government, there is very, very deep and sustained working relationships with the Mexican government. That's not true of any other government in the world, to my knowledge. And this explains how disorienting and disturbing some of the rhetoric we've heard from the president has on Mexico, how it's going down in Mexico. I've spoken to a lot of Mexicans and touched with a lot of Mexicans, and there is a sense of enormous concern, alarm about what might happen. Mexico was used as the proxy for Trump on the two issues that propelled his candidacy and got him to the White House, immigration and trade. Both of those came together in the case of Mexico. And we've seen since January 20th that the president seems to be determined to put the words and the rhetoric into action. And that's something that some people thought wasn't gonna happen, but clearly, at least what we've seen so far indicates that it will. Building a wall, more deportations, renegotiating or scrapping NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, has generated a lot of nervousness, concern, uncertainty in Mexico. But let me just say that it's not just limited to Mexico. 11 countries in Latin America and the Caribbean, including Colombia, Peru, Chile, have free trade agreements with the United States. It's not just NAFTA. Although the other agreements haven't been talked about, they're there. And they're part of the agenda because this is free trade. This is a conviction. This is a very strongly held view that the president seems to be pursuing. And immigration as well. When there's a building a wall on the border between the United States and Mexico, it's not just Mexico that's offended, that reacts very strongly. It's widely felt throughout Latin America. And the former president of Chile, Ricardo Lagos, has said last week, he said, we're all Mexicans. We're all with Mexico in solidarity with them. So this is to say, well, this is Mexico and that's Latin America. No, on these kind of issues of immigration, even though there may not be a lot of immigration from a lot of countries in South America, it's still something that sends a message to the whole, to the South, looking South, and that's felt as well. I think the test is going to be, I think, going back to my original point, I think we're going to see what happens with the visit meetings tomorrow in Mexico between the Secretary of State and head of Homeland Security, whether they have any authority, decision-making on policy towards Mexico, or will this simply be controlled from the president and other members of the White House staff. That's the panorama that we're looking at. There's a lot of support in Congress for Mexico among Republicans and Democrats. NAFTA was in 1994. This was the beginning of the Bill Clinton administration. So there is, again, how are you going to, other players, other decision makers, other leaders, how will they respond to this situation? I'm sure that Tillerson and Kelly will try to reassure and calm things down in Mexico. Whether he'll succeed or not, I don't know. And of course, it depends on how their boss behaves closer to Mexico. Finally, there's been a lot of talk about, well, in this context of uncertainty, of the United States really seems to be changing course on basic policies that have been in place for so long, maybe this is an opportunity for Latin America to build regional integration. Regional integration has been weak in Latin America. Countries trade, but they don't trade with each other. And maybe this is an opportunity to bring all countries together, countries of the Pacific, countries of the Atlantic, which have different trading blocks. And then, of course, the South America, and they forget about Mexico, because Mexico is so tied to the United States. So there's a lot of talk about doing more from Brazil to Mexico, or Argentina to Mexico, Peru to Mexico, because Mexico has been kind of apart from it all. We'll see where this goes, but that's one of the issues that's being discussed a lot, whether we might see some sort of realignment and an opportunity to strengthen regional integration in Latin America. China, as I said, has been involved in the region, and despite its economic slowdown, there are all signs that its strategy is even more aggressive, to be more engaged, more involved in the region. There is a meeting of countries on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which, as you know, has now been killed, that involves 11 countries in the Pacific, including Japan, as well as three Latin American countries, Chile, Peru, and Mexico. There's a meeting in Chile soon with those members, as well as other countries interested in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, like Colombia, to talk about perhaps moving forward, but without the United States. And if the United States politically simply can't support this, well, and if other countries are interested, do we need the United States? And China is going to be present at that meeting. If you listen to President Xi at the APEC meeting in Lima, or you listen to his talk in Davos at the latest conference, he's talking about free trade, globalization. And when he was in Lima, Peru, I wasn't at the meeting, but my colleagues told me that there was a lot of positive reaction and enthusiasm on the part of other Latin American governments to what he was proposing. So if the United States wants to pull back, China is very, very pleased to fill the void. And Latin Americans, again, going back to my main theme of being more pragmatic, saying, you know, we have difficulties. We need investment. We need trade. We need to build jobs. They're prepared to go. They're not doing this for ideological reasons because of China and Latin America. They're doing it because they want to have resources in order to deal with their problems. And that's the situation. Now, one advantage in Latin America of dealing with this current situation is that this is not new in Latin America. The article in The Economist this week called The Peronist on the Potomac. Latin Americans understand the phenomena of Trump. They know the reasons behind it, inequality, which has always been the Achilles heel of Latin America, and now is a bigger problem than ever in the United States. Discontent, anxiety. This is a familiar story in Latin America. And I think Latin Americans have a understanding, perhaps more than those of other parts of the world, why this is happening. They've seen this movie before. And we just all hope that this movie will have a happy ending. Thank you very much.
I wanted to begin by asking, and thanks again for your tremendous presentation here. As you think about the prospect of the wall, whether it is built or not, but particularly if construction begins, to what degree does this risk becoming of outsized symbolic importance in the same way that with many Latin American leaders and citizens alike, that the diplomatic disengagement between Havana and Washington became a symbol that was an impediment to closer relations with the United States and many countries in the region?
Well, thank you. Thank you, John, for that question. This is clearly a sensitive point for Latin Americans. It is offensive. It does have evokes an emotional response. I think the Cuba issue was different, was steeped in the Cold War and the U.S. punishing Cuba while it was having relations with China and other countries that's with problematic human rights performance. We're at a point where, and on the wall, something is going to happen. We know that. It can't not happen. Politically, that's not possible. The question is, you know, what and how will it be managed? And it can't be managed in a way where something could happen, but in reality, it won't mean a lot. There may be some theater, there may be some show. I mean, this is the world that we live in, unfortunately, and this is, and that I think is the challenge of how to figure out how to do that. If it's done in a way that is really follows through with the rhetoric that we've been hearing, then it becomes really, you know, then it becomes a real problem, and I think it could you know, renew some of the hostilities, not just with Mexico, obviously, but further south in Latin America, and done physically in the way that's been described with the accompanying rhetoric. That's just going to be seen as just extremely aggressive, and you know, I think it could become serious. I'm not sure, you know, if the comparison with the Cuba policy, you know, there are some similarities. I think it's different, but I think there is a risk of that depending on how it's managed.
You gave a great overview of different political dynamics in different Latin American countries, and I'm quite confident we're going to get some follow-on questions that have a high degree of sophistication and specificity to that. But I wanted to talk about another transnational issue that affects all corners of the globe, and Latin America certainly, and in some pockets of it, acutely, and that is environmental challenges. And if you could give us a little bit of a view of where they're hitting the hardest, how they may be impacting societies and politics, and accordingly, eventually, the relationship with the United States.
Well, I think there's been enormous progress in the recognition of these issues, in environmental issues in Latin America in recent years. I think they've come a long way, and of course, going back in the United States, I think, could slow that down in Latin America. talk. I mean, the United States is important, and it's been an important part of the agenda in the United States, certainly in the last 8 years. And if that changes, I think simply that Latin Americans won't continue to do that, to go forward. But, you know, there are a lot of, I think if you go from country to country, there are a lot of different environmental concerns, deforestation, other concerns, water issues. We just actually did a report, the dialogue on environmental issues in the peace process in Colombia, because you know there's on the one hand there's you know there's if some of these areas that have been conflict ridden become peaceful, then they become more propitious for investments, but there could be the kind of investments that have negative environmental effects. So in some ways, our effort was try to figure out how can you really build peace, but do it in a way that's you adhere to certain environmental standards and you're sensitive to those. So all of these things are there. But I think in general the region has come a long way. Made a lot of progress in devising policies to deal with environmental problems. The awareness, the consciousness has increased. But again, I think if the United States goes backward on this, that has an effect. I'm afraid to say.
Another transnational issue, of course, are narcotics and the associated crime. Here in the United States, of course, the unprecedented appetite for drug consumption fuels a lot of this problem. But how is this playing out in between Latin American countries? And what do you anticipate in terms of perhaps calls from some of those countries for legalization in North America, let alone Central and South America, to try to ameliorate the violence that is associated with this?
Mm-hmm. Well, there have been, I think there is a consensus in Latin America that the traditional approach in fighting drugs, so-called war on drugs, which has been around since Richard Nixon, hasn't really worked. There's been billions of dollars that have been spent and very little to show for it. Coca production is still up, the price hasn't changed, its availability hasn't changed. All these things that were supposedly the objectives and the goals of drug policy have not improved. The consensus breaks down when you look at what are the alternatives. And you know, there are some countries like Colombia, Peru, Bolivia that are producers. Others are transit countries, others are consumer countries. And depending on what your connection is to the drug issue, you have a different approach. So there isn't, I don't see anyway, any sort of unified sort of regional alternative. What there is a call to sort of to look for other options and to tailor them from country to country, depending on what the connection of the country is to the drug issue. But clearly, what's been in place of the drug policy hasn't worked. Let me just say, I think this administration, what we see, General Kelly, this Attorney General, others, this issue, which had kind of diminished importance, it was important during the 80s and the 90s in the United States. If you look at public opinion, the drug issue had diminished, I think is coming back because of what's happening here and also what's happening in the region, and also because of this administration. I think it's going to get a higher priority from Washington than we've seen in recent years.
Thank you, and thank you all for some tremendous questions I already can see, and I haven't been through even a quarter of them here. But you talked, Michael, about the pink tide that in many ways rode the wave of commodity prices, oil in particular, but natural gas and some other situations. And a question comes, how can Latin America get out of the commodity dependency with governments that are very corrupt, laws that don't support investments, and very low qualified workers? How can the cycle be broken?
Boy, that's
the, told you these are good questions.
That's a great question. You know, this is why there are people that are, you know, the pessimists say, well, you know, boom and bust, and this is a cycle. We've seen this before, and it keeps going back. And you know, everybody's now talking about, you know, there are a lot of people sitting around talking about what happens when Venezuela collapses, what should be their, you know, what should be their economic strategy. And, you know, everybody talks about diversification, that really this was the sort of the oil curse, depending on oil, because you depended on the price, and the price goes down, and you collapse, and you have nothing. And you know what previous governments in Venezuela said, well, the problem that we, in their moment of self-criticism, they said, we should have diversified. Now they're saying we need to diversify. It just doesn't, it hasn't happened. Everybody can agree on it intellectually and say, you know, it is crazy that 96% of the economy is oil. And that's just not, you know, if you want to have, you need greater balance, you need greater diversity, diversification, and so forth. So, you know, it has to be, you know, maybe it takes this, you know, hitting bottom to realize, and Venezuela is as close to bottom as you're going to get, you know, that this is no, you know, that if looking forward, we simply can't go back to relying on this commodity. But I think it's, you know, what does it take? It takes committed leaders who understand the problem, understand the consequences, to see what it's producing in a country like Venezuela, where 96% depends on oil, and to say, you know, this is simply unacceptable, and we need to encourage other sectors and other things so that we have a more balanced economic. But it hasn't happened. But you know, I mean, that's what it takes. It takes people who, with vision, who understand this, who are committed to pursuing a different set of ideas.
Another economic question, but with geostrategic consequences. And the question is, has China attempted to translate its economic ties into any political realms, such as supporting styles of governance or engaging in dialogue on security issues?
Well, not really. They're really focused on economic questions. But at the same time, you know, if they are providing $65 billion to Venezuela in financing, that has political implications. Or Ecuador, or others, other countries. So it's not that they're getting involved in the internal governance issues or political questions, in part because they're very careful, the Chinese in general are very careful. They don't want to jeopardize their relationship with the United States over Latin America. And they know that they see that this is the United States has been traditionally much more involved in Latin America, so they have really mainly focused on economic issues. But clearly, the choices, decisions they made, and the countries they make, and when they make them, have political ramifications.
A related follow-on question, do you see Russia gaining in prominence in the region?
Russia had a relationship, sold arms to Chavez, and had a relationship with Venezuela. I don't think that Russia really has the ability to, again, their area or sphere is more with the security area, whereas China is economics, basically. But I just think that it's been, the Russian involvement has been limited. There's been some in Nicaragua. Under Chavez, you know, Chavez bought arms from Russia, so there's been some arms sales and the like, but I don't think that they've been a very significant player, and I'm not worried. I think certainly from the U.S. policy point of view, depending on when, we'll see where U.S.-Russian relations go. I don't know where they're going to go, but you know, if U.S.-Russian relations, you know, deteriorate for some reason, then I think to the extent there's Russian involvement in this in Latin America, that's going to become a greater concern to the United States.
Some great questions about Colombia, and I'm going to ask a few of them here. With the revision of the Colombian Constitution in 1991 to include numerous amounts of rights, giving it the nickname the Constitution of Human Rights, how do you think El Pacto de Paz will, with the FARC, will influence or affect the Constitution itself? Do you or anyone else foresee amendments being added or sections of the Constitution being modified in order to better establish a long-term peace in Colombia?
That's a great question. I think that you know, there has been a lot of talk, including what the FARC has asked for, and this they have an agreement with the former president, Álvaro Uribe, who's been a strong critic of President Santos, of having a constituent assembly. The Santos government, I think, understandably and for good reason, has not wanted to do that. I think that's, in some ways, the problem. I think the 1991 Constitution perhaps with some adjustments, some minor changes, should be kept intact. I mean, the problem in Colombia is you have enormous polarization. Despite the peace agreement, which I think is good, is moving forward, it's clearly part of the country that is not happy about it. I mean, that's it lost in the election. So I think if opening up some of these issues, the level of the Constitution, I think is risky. And I think, there may be legitimate issues that need to be addressed, but I think you have to balance that against opening up something that could really kind of be very, very hard to manage and contain.
Relatedly, can you shed light on the relationship between Colombia and Venezuela, and what are the prospects in the near future?
I think one of the issues that concern Colombians, when I speak to Colombian officials and cabinet members, and including the president and others, what do you worry about with this peace process and peace implementation now? Near the top of the list is Venezuela. One doesn't know, I don't think anybody knows in this room or anywhere what's going to happen in Venezuela, but one of the scenarios is quite, is quite dramatic, and of just a collapse and meltdown and chaos and lack of control. And just like the United States and Mexico are very interconnected, Colombia and Venezuela are very interconnected. There are a lot of Colombians who live in Venezuela. There are migratory flows back and forth. At one point, they had $7 billion in bilateral trade between Colombia and Venezuela. That has obviously gone down because of the Venezuelan crisis. But I think that's the Venezuela, depending on what happened in Venezuela, that could really complicate efforts by the Colombians to try to build peace. There's a lot of criminality in Venezuela, and so the drug trade and drug trafficking has increased in Venezuela. So this is of great concern. At the same time, let me say that the President Santos, and he's been criticized for this, has been working with Venezuela because they were the government that had the most influence with the FARC. And so in order to get this peace agreement signed, having Venezuela involved was important, but that meant that Colombia had to hold back in terms of any criticism of Chavez and then of Maduro. So it's been difficult for them. They've been in a tough position.
That, of course, is one key regional relationship, and yet the dearth of them is something that you talked about. And the question is, you've mentioned that the region does not engage in regional agreements historically. In your perspective, what are the reasons for that?
Great question. I mean, part is that that I think that there are the region is uneven, and I think there are different levels of economic development or productivity from country to country, and I think that makes it hard to work together. I think that there's just a lot of suspicion, mistrust from one country to another. There's Latin America, there's a sort of identity of regionalism, of working together, and this Bolivarian idea that Chavez articulated himself. But at the same time, there's also just an instinct to pursue national interests, national agenda. So I think it has something to do with economic differences, different levels of productivity and the like, but I also think it's just been, I think that Latin Americans have been preferred to look at, to take advantage of options and seize opportunities. They are globally connected. The problem is within the region, there's very little trade within the region itself, and I think that's something that needs to increase.
We're gonna move north with a few questions and key concerns, both of from a foreign policy perspective and perhaps from some people in this room. And you touched on the problems of Central America, the question begins, but didn't mention Costa Rica and or Panama. What are these countries doing right?
Well, there's very different history in the case of, first of all, neither Costa Rica nor Panama has an army. I mean, that's a start. Costa Rica hasn't had one since 1948, and Panama didn't have one until dissolved it after the Noriega in under the Bush administration. You know, the histories are very, very different, in these countries. And I don't think it's difficult to sort of extract, lessons, from Costa Rica. They just don't have the pressures. There isn't the, Costa Rica has had very, historically, very, enlightened social policies, strong institutions. This has a whole different history than the countries of the Northern Triangle. They're much more problematic and has more of a state capacity to do things. The other states and the other countries have been very weak. And of course, the other countries were also involved in civil wars. Salvador had a civil war and 80,000 people were killed. And Guatemala had a civil war and insurgency. A lot of people were killed. Honduras was used as part of the was used as a platform for that conflict. So there's that. And it comes back to the basic problem of state legitimacy, state presence, rule of law. There are a lot of areas in Honduras and Guatemala that are just ungoverned spaces and that are breeding grounds for criminal groups. That's not the case in Costa Rica. So there are a variety of factors that explain that.
Thank you. Still further north, a couple questions regarding Mexico. And one is, how important are remittances to Mexico's economy, and do they affect the GDP? And can remittances hurt America's economy? So we'll start on that. I'll jump to a follow-on in a moment.
Remittances, I forget the exact figure, but remittances are extremely important to Mexico's economy. They're not, percentage-wise, it's not the same percentage as El Salvador, Guatemala and Honduras, Central America, but it's certainly more than Colombia and certainly more other countries. So it's very, very important. Of course, now there's talk about taxing remittances. This is something that this administration has at least floated. Whether that's
for the wall, correct?
What? In part, that was one of the ideas, to pay for the wall, to tax remittances. I don't know. I think that's feasible or not. But this is obviously very, very important for the economy and the remittances from Mexico, particularly. We did a report on this from 2016. Figures have grown significantly from 2015. So the level of remittances are increasing from Mexico, and the costs of remittances have gone down a lot. They used to be much more costly, and now there are some considerations about how to use them for development purposes in these countries, not just for consumption at the family individual level.
And you mentioned that the prominence of the pink tide has generally subsided from the region as a whole. But how do you explain the rising support of López Obrador in Mexico?
Well, partly he's benefiting from what he's seeing in Washington. This is a great gift for López Obrador. I think there is interesting. López Obrador is for those who have declared the death of populism, you do have to look at López Obrador, and I think that's why I said I think it's very. I'm much more cautious. I think it's subsided, but I don't think it's disappeared. It's lost force in many of these commodity-fueled countries in South America. But, in Mexico, the political parties are in terrible shape. Peña Nieto, the president, has less than 20% support. The other parties, the PAN and the PRD, are not in good shape. And I think López Obrador is taking advantage of the rhetoric coming from Trump, and his numbers as a result are going up. I'm not sure that he'll eventually win, but I do think it's been commented by even Rafael Correa at one point said Trump may be the best thing to bring back the left in Latin America. He made that comment himself. He said I'd prefer that Hillary Clinton win, but on the other hand, it would probably be the best thing for the left in Latin America if Trump won. So even he himself sort of recognized that it could play out in that way.
Well, you mentioned in your introduction how kind Carol Byrne and her colleagues at Global Minnesota were to pull you out of Washington, but I'm the tough guy who's going to bring you back here and perhaps make you
yearn. It's too good to be true.
Yearn for the snowstorm we're about to get here. You may want to stay. So some questions as we move north here about our capital and about our approach to Latin America. And indeed, that's just the broad question here is what, if anything, are you hearing about the Trump administration's approach to greater Latin America? And it says beyond the obvious matters like the wall.
I think there's been very little thought given to the region. There's no team in place. You need to have a team. You need to have people to give ideas of what should be done, so you have a discussion, and then whatever decisions made to carry them out. There have been some decisions that have been made on Venezuela, applying sanctions to the vice president. It came out by the Treasury Department considering him a drug kingpin. That investigation had been going on for a long time, but the United States under Obama didn't want to make that decision because they were hoping for some dialogue between the government and the opposition they were supporting, and they figured if they did that, that would ruin the dialogue, and they're right, but the dialogue is over, so the Trump administration is moving that. But I don't think that reflects a carefully thought out approach or strategy on how to deal with Venezuela or the region. And there's been very little said about the region. He has had some conversations with the president of Colombia, with the president of Argentina, with the president of Peru, but I don't, I think there's very little, there's a lot of speculation, but I don't think anybody really has a clear idea.
Well, to what degree does the dearth of these clear ideas relate to our next question, which is, what is your take on the systematic dismantling of the State Department and its impact on Latin American U.S. relations?
Well, it's, we'll see what happens in the State Department under Tillerson, but obviously there's a real problem there, and I think that the State Department is always seen by, Latin Americans, I think rightly, always say, what's the role of the military, what's the role of diplomacy? And obviously there's a long history of military intervention in Latin America. There hasn't been recently, but there is historically. There have been some columns I've read by Latin Americans who talk about the concern about having, generals in high positions, Mattis and Kelly and now McMaster, but those are the good guys, so supposedly. So I mean, this is a concern. I think that to the extent that the State Department is dismantled and is, and we'll see what happens. I think that remains to be seen. That creates a lot of problems and lack of confidence and concern in Latin America. So far, as far as I understand it, the ambassador to Mexico is still there under the Obama administration. The ambassador, our person in Havana, is still there. He was nominated by Obama to be ambassador, but he never got confirmed by the Senate. So there have been no real people still in place. That I think doesn't reflect a well thought out plan. It just reflects that they haven't gotten to it yet. And that's just very, very slow.
Well, you mentioned the role of the military, and the next question is, how active is the U.S. Southern Command in the region?
Mostly active in Central America, because that's where, most of, and John Kelly, who is the, Secretary of Homeland Security, has spent a lot of time in Central America. He was one of the proponents of this Alliance for Prosperity, which is a cooperation program with the Northern Triangle countries. So it's mostly Central America, because that's where the security challenges are most acute. But there's also Colombia. There's been a very strong connection to Colombia, training, working with the Colombian military. That was part of Plan Colombia, which was the cooperation between the United States and Colombia to try to contain the FARC, to try to deal with the drug issue. So there have been Colombia and Central America have been the main areas of greatest involvement of Southern Command.
We've been very generous with your time tonight, as is everyone being here. So I'm gonna close with one question. As an expert on the region, and we greatly appreciate you sharing your perspective throughout the hemisphere. And as you look to the Caribbean, or you know, South America, Central America, what is the one situation or nation that isn't being discussed enough, might be on the back pages of a newspaper, and could be on the front pages in the next few years, that if you were advising the State Department or President Trump, you would say, don't take your eyes off this?
That's an easy question. Haiti.
Elaborate, Haiti. Please.
No, Haiti is, you know, there is a terrible situation. Obviously, it's had a lot of problems and have had, you know, tragedies. And it's just very tempting to sort of throw up your hands and say, well, we can't do anything, we've tried. And I think that, and I see this in Washington, not only in the government, but among, you know, in the think tank world, in the policy world, as you go through the list of recommendations and things to pay attention to, Haiti is totally left out. And I think it's part of the hemisphere. It's a country that's gone through an enormous amount. And it's true that what's been tried hasn't worked. But I think it's a serious mistake to write it off. And it's very easy to do so. So I would urge constructive, positive attention to that situation.
Well, thank you for sharing your experience and expertise. And I'll turn it back to Carol Byrne.